This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Baby, I'm home.
Welcome, everybody, and thank you so much, Parker. I'm Jim Irvin, and this is Time Signatures. The Chicago blues scene in the 1960s and 70s was an incredibly fast-paced time. On any given night, you could catch Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Buddy Guy, Willie Dixon, or a host of other big-name bluesmen on the bandstands of Chicago's clubs. But there were also some young white guys finding their way into the blues circuit, and you've heard about them a few times here already. Paul Butterfield, Mike Bloomfield, Corky Siegel, and many others like them were sitting at the feet of these blues giants, learning all they could about this amazing music. And fortunately for them, the aforementioned bluesmen of the day recognized their passion and respect, and they were welcomed into the fold with open arms. Well, another young man found his way to the Chicago blues scene, and it didn't take long to land a position with the great Otis Rush, where he played for several years. There's a great deal to talk about here, so let's welcome a man I am honored to have with me today. Ladies and gentlemen, guitarist, bassist, harmonicist, and the originator of the One Man Jam and member of the Artist Protection Program, come on in here, Billy Pruitt, and welcome to Time Signatures. How you doing, buddy?
Thank you, Jim. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well, man. We got so much to talk about here. But first things first, Billy, where did your music and journey in music ultimately begin?
As a little kid, my parents really never listened to much music. My dad was from Kosciuszko, Mississippi, so he was a real straight kind of guy. And sure. I just started paying attention to music about in high school when I was 15 or 16, in Omaha, Nebraska, of all places. Buddy Miles started there. And that's when I really first became aware of blues. I heard stuff on the radio, Ray Charles and all that. And I said, man, this is some cool music. And my dad was from Mississippi and he was, sort of a backwards thinker. He was a good dad and provided well. And he was real supportive about everything. But he didn't quite understand why I was listening to Ray Charles and all this stuff on the radio, you know. I said, Dad, this is some really good music. And he goes, well, why do you have to listen to like this gospel stuff? Why don't you listen to, there's Pat Boone and stuff like that on the radio. You could listen to nice stuff. And the more he didn't understand it, the more I got into it. And so I started listening to, I bought some Jimmy Reed albums at a record store. I was in a corner of the record store and it was all the straight stuff. And then I saw a little dark corner over in the corner of the record store, and there was Bo Diddley, Red yeah. Fox, Paul Butterfield blues album. I said, what, Paul Butterfield? This was like, early 60s. And I said, Paul Butterfield, and I turned the album over, and I said, this looks interesting. And I had a bunch of guys sitting on a back porch in Chicago. And so I just brought it all home, Jimmy Reed home. Of course, I was listening to Chuck Berry and all the stuff that was on the radio, too. And so I started listening to all these blues the original Jimmy Reed, which was 2120 South Michigan Avenue. It's about five blocks from where I live here. And of course, I didn't know that stuff then. And so I got into the sound of the blues. I don't know what it was. It was the magic of the black blues music really, really got me off. Just the groove of it all. So that's where I started. That's where I started listening.
Billy, you mentioned in an earlier interview that you experienced a life-changing moment when you were about 12 years old. So we're going to take a little step back here.
Okay.
When the song Stay came on the radio by Maurice Williams. Talk about that for me, would you please?
Oh, man, that was back in Indianapolis before Omaha, okay. Nebraska. I was, my parents sent me to military school and I came home and I wanted to go to regular high school because there were girls there. And, I bought some albums. I heard I heard Stay by Maurice Williams and Book of Love, the monotones, yip, 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 bum, bum, bum.
Oh, yeah.
And that really caught my ear. And I said, man, this is really some cool stuff. So that's what hooked me. And then I was crossed between, I was listening to Everly Brothers at that time too, and the Everly Harmony. I said, man, this is all kind of a melting pot. And so between the Everly Harmony and Stay, but when I heard Stay, that's the first time I really got chills, you know, just where the hair on my arm stood up in the back of my neck. And I said,
Yeah.
whoa, man, this is really some down to it, almost gospel, but I didn't know what gospel was at that time. I was an uneducated kid going to high school. And that's what when I really got into it.
Would you say that that moment is where you realize that you're probably destined to be a musician for life?
Oh yeah, I was, oh yeah. I said, this is something I want to do the rest of my life, and I'm going to do it. Nobody's going to stop me. And of course my parents says, well, you can't even read music. You can't do this. I said, I don't think I have to, Dad. I can just make stuff up and play. And I already had a guitar. I didn't have my first Stratocaster yet, but I had a I had an old guitar, and I was learning Chuck Berry songs, and I knew three chords. And I said, well, geez, I can write stuff around this, which was really Johnny Be Good with different words, you know. But I said, this is original material. And so my dad said, you can't hope to make a living doing this. And I said, well, I'm going to try. So, that's when I really decided that I got to try this no matter what.
You are, by your own definition, a self-taught musician.
Yeah.
You learned guitar, harmonica, and bass on your own. That really took some dedication, didn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I believe talent is second only to drive. I believe anybody can acquire anything if they do it 1,000 times. You can do it. I think I'm living proof. Because I didn't pick it up and I just magically just started playing. It took a long time. I struggled a lot, but I never had any lessons. So I just had to sit down with the records. And at that time, there was no YouTube. Now you can go on YouTube and they show you the
Oh,
fingering and how
yeah.
to do stuff. But I had to sit down with the records and just struggle is only where, people go, what key are you struggling in? And I said, I don't know, what's a key? I just started fooling around, and then I said, oh, I think I got something close.
Yes, sir. Now, at the age of 16, you enlisted in the Air Force. You got to see a bit of the
Very good.
world, I imagine, and experience a little
Correct.
bit of life. Did you
Right.
dabble in music while you were serving in the Air Force?
Yeah, I was I played with some bands, and I used to go to the Airmen's Club. I was
Okay.
16 when I joined the Air Force, and so
Man.
I was an airman third class and went to basic training at Lackland Air Force Base. And it's a funny story, because I wanted to go. I knew I had to go in the service. So when I was in Omaha, my dad says, you can't read music. Why don't you go in the Air Force and or a anything and any branch of service, Air Force, Marines, whatever. So I went down to the local shopping center, which had all the little storefronts of, it said join the Marines, a big sign of a guy with his head shaved. And so I kind of looked in there and they were sitting up stiff, and I said, I don't like that. And so, I went into the Army storefront, and it just didn't look appealing to me. And then I saw a little place that says "Join the Air Force." It was down at the end of the hall with a little flickering neon fluorescent light. And so I walked in that, and this guy, this overweight sergeant, had his feet up on the desk, and he was watching TV with his back to me. And I walked in, and I said, "What is this?" And he turned around, he goes, "Son, this is the Air Force." And I said, "Oh, this sounds." I had my sideburns and my Elvis pompadour, and I said, "Oh, well, can I join the Air Force?" He goes, "Yeah, when I'm done watching, The Price is Right here." And so I said, "Can I?" And he goes, "We see a few guys like you walking around like that." And I said, "Oh, okay, great." And so I said, "Sign me up." So that was it. So I got a paper bag, and my mom put my underwear and some candy bars in there, and I went to Lackland Air Force Base, and that's where I went through basic, and then I ended up at Castle Air Force Base and Vandenberg Air Force Base, and I played guitar in the Airmen's Club, and I knew enough chords by then to get a job with at least
Sure.
the Airmen's Club. I couldn't get in the Officers Club, but the Airmen's Club I could do. So.
And then when you got out, you made a major connection with Wayne Cochran after your move to Miami. This was a connection that really would alter the trajectory of your life, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that was I had a band called What's Left, and I still hadn't heavily gotten into the blues. So we were playing, we couldn't think of a name for the band, and we said, geez, we like the Who, but that's not a very good name, and there already is a Who. We said nothing's left, so we named the band What's Left. And our manager at that time got us a job at playing at the house as one of the house bands next to Wayne Cochran at a place called The Barn in Miami. And it started at like 9 at night, and it went to about 3 in the morning. And Wayne was doing like 45-minute sets, and then we'd do half-hour sets in between them. And we'd start the night with a little. We were like an English band. We weren't, it was almost like a Beatle copy band. And
Okay.
we'd start playing, and we'd do a half hour, and then, the setup was that they'd come on. Wayne had a bunch of horns, and they'd come on and start playing the last song we were playing at the same time without stopping. And the horns would come up one by one, and then pretty soon there was a big horn band, and then we'd leave one by one. And then finally Wayne would come out and he'd do this James Brown thing. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And so I discovered James Brown. I said, I went right to the source, right to the horse's mouth. And that's how I got into James Brown, is at the barn
Wow.
in Miami. We were young and inexperienced, but we shared the dressing room with Wayne Cochran, and that was interesting. That was a good training ground for me.
And from there, you moved to New York, and that was at the Village where you met Paul Butterfield. And as I was reading, Paul was recording the album Keep On Moving, and you met him in the elevator. I've got to hear this story, man.
Said, I gotta get a job. I gotta figure out this harmonica thing. I gotta get a job, playing guitar. And I hadn't moved to Chicago yet, so I put all my instruments in my Volks. I had a little Volkswagen Beetle Bug, and I said, well, I'm leaving all this Wayne Cochran stuff and the Beetle bands, and I'm moving to New York, because that's I gotta meet Paul, and I gotta go to the Village, the Village. And I moved to Chicago. I mean, I moved to New York, and got a place at the Albert Hotel. That was the cheapest hotel at the time. It was about $10 a night. And Paul Butterfield and his band was staying there at that time. So I thought, oh man, this is how I can meet him, So maybe I can hang around the studio and everything. So I hung out in the hallway of the Albert Hotel. It's long been since torn down, but I hung out to ambush him. I waited there for hours, and I came in one night after playing at a place in the Village. I think I can't remember the place, but anyway, he came in, and so he walked into the elevator, and I said, "Hey, Paul, my name's Billy Pruitt, and I'm a harmonica player and guitar player, and I was wondering, I thought maybe if I could ask him to hang around the studio." I said, "Do you mind? I know you're recording down the street here, and you're doing that great album." I said, "Could I? Do you mind if I'd hang out, just in the studio a little bit, and I could just kind of hang around and learn some things?" And he goes, "No," and the elevator door closed, and that was my encounter with Paul Butterfield. So that was a good. These guys are hard, so I guess I'm not going to get in the studio. And so I just hung around New York and played with some bands, and then I said, I gotta move to Chicago. And that's when I said, I'm gonna pull the trigger and bite the bullet and move to Chicago, and I'm just gonna start hanging around. And as soon as I moved here, there was a place called Mother Blues, 1446 North, and that was the big hideout then. That was the big hangout, because that's where I read on the Butterfield album he had been playing at Big John's, which was at North and Wells. So as soon as I got to Chicago, I walked down to North and Wells. There was a big parking lot there, and I said, "Oh man, what?" I asking some people. I said, "Is Big John's around here?" And they said, "Oh, they tore it down. That's the vacant lot." I said, "Oh man." So I went down to Mother Blues, and they had entertainment every night for, and it was like a $2 cover charge every night. There was like Muddy Waters, Magic Sam, Howlin' Wolf. Every night for like $2, and I got to know Lorraine Blue, which was who they called Mother Blues, and she could see that I was hungry to learn, and so she quit charging me the $2 cover, and I'd go down there every night and just walk in, and There's some funny stories on the podcast. I sat in with Wolf and I played too fast and he kind of threw me off the stage, and that's a very funny story. That's one of the episodes on my podcast. And so I heard Wolf and Magic Sam didn't need any help. He wouldn't let me up. And one night Otis Rush was playing there, and he was such a clean dressed gentleman. All these blues guys had Wolf would wear these coveralls, these overalls, like he came off the farm. And Otis had a white shirt and a suit and a tie. And I said, man, I said this. So I listened to him for a while, and I said, man, this guy, he's a real blues guy, but he looks like a gentleman. And he came down, and I said, Otis, I don't, I'm afraid we're going to get the Paul Butterfield experience here. And I said, I'm new in town, and I'm a guitar player, and I'd like to, you could probably show me the ropes. And I really didn't know how famous he was at that time. He was already a big star in Europe,
Sure.
and he'd go to Japan, all over Europe. He was a huge star. He had lots of albums, and I thought he was just a local band like Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters, the bands that play there every night. I said, this is a cool neighborhood. This is, man, this is these are local bands. How cool is this? So, I asked Otis. I said, do you mind? Could I maybe audition for you, and maybe you'd consider, I could be a rhythm guitar player. And so he says, yeah, he's come up last set, and so there's my guitar, go up and start the set, and I played a little bit, and that's another episode on my podcast. I was scared, and I just did my best, and I came down, and Otis said, yeah, would you like to join my band? And I said, yeah. And he goes, okay. He says, we don't rehearse, but it's just blues. Just listen, and I'll kind of show you what to play. And that he says, our first gig, which was his next gig, was the first Ann Arbor Blues Festival. That was '69 in Ann Arbor Blues, Michigan. And so that was my first experience in front of 10,000 people. 10,000
Man.
people. There I was in front of 10,000 people. So that
You
was
know,
my training ground, Sam.
yeah, talk about a trial by fire, man. I live about an hour away from Ann Arbor, and
Oh.
I was only four at the time, so I didn't get to go. I didn't get to see it, but I do have a copy of the album. I got a box set down here with the albums and stuff. But everybody was there. I mean, if they were in the blues, if they meant anything to the
Yeah.
world of the blues, they were all there. I got to ask you from the perspective of, at the time, a very, very young Billy Pruitt, what was
Yeah.
that experience like for you, other than having the crap scared out of you?
It didn't scare me, because I thought, when I came to Chicago with Otis and all those guys,
Yeah.
everything I learned was taught to me by black traditional musicians, and I'm proud of that. And they always sense that, and they always protected me, and I never had any problem about being scared.
Well, I guess just the experience, I guess, is what I was referring to, the experience of being in front of 10,000 people.
Oh, that was, yeah, that was, I just, I didn't know what I thought, man, I'm glad I'm not the leader of the band, because he's got to sing and all that. But that was overwhelming. The first, you were 4 in 69, you were 4 years
Yes,
old
sir.
in 69.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I was probably 20. And I just, yeah, I just, it was just, that was, well, it was the first Ann Arbor Blues Festival, so it had never been
Yeah.
before, and nobody knew if anybody was even going to show up. And that was the same year the Woodstock was around
Yeah.
69. Nobody knew, a 500,000 people come to Woodstock. So 10,000 festival. It was over 3 days, I think, and there was all kind, Wolf, everybody played there. Everybody played there. And
Everybody.
so I, we were just hanging around backstage. There was no backstage. It was just an open field, and it was overwhelming to me. There's not one picture of that. There's no videos or anything, because that was the first one. Nobody came. So if
Man.
anybody has any pictures, that'd be great. I'd love to have a picture of Otis Knight,
Well,
that first one,
I'm hoping to get a chance to interview the gentleman that worked with the Blues Fest. Still, I'm working on that. But you mentioned the trip up there from Chicago, Billy. What was that experience like, taking your first, I mean, you just joined the band, and here you are, you're taking a road trip with these guys. What was that like for you?
I'd never hung out with real blues guys, you know.
Right.
My experience was down in Florida and Omaha playing with Beatle bands and all that. And here I am, accepted. You know, I really felt accepted, a black band had accepted me. I remember the first job I played with Otis, after the Ann Arbor Blues Festival. We just played all the local clubs, and they were just a little bar, the bar and everything. And I never really had any fear. And I remember one night I was playing with Otis at a place on North Avenue, real close to where Big John's used to be. And Otis would always give me like one solo during his set, and so I had to really make it count. And I remember I played this one solo. I played my heart out, and I tried to do good. And Otis looked at me and smiled, and a guy came up to me, and he laid a $5 bill, at my feet. And it was my first tip, and I got $5 for that solo, and I've got it framed in my living room, because that was my
You still
first,
have it.
I've got it
Wow.
framed. An all black crowd of working class people, came up, and here I was, a white boy playing with Otis, and I played a solo, and he accepted me, and that to me, that's the biggest compliment in the world. I mean, that's better than reading music or anything my dad could say, I mean, I was accepted. And so then I really started digging in and trying to get good playing guitar and harp.
Yes, sir. One more question on Ann Arbor Blues Fest. Do you have any great stories, things that stick out in your mind as something that is a memorable experience while you were there with all of these greats?
Ann Arbor, I was just sitting off stage. We only played the one day. There was 3 days, I think. And I think the day we played, Wolf and Muddy played, I think. And people that I'd never heard. I mean, I thought they were local bands. I mean, I didn't know. I had no idea that Otis, was an international star already. I had no idea that Wolf had already recorded Smokestack Lightning and all these classic songs that were brand
Wow.
new to me, and so I was just sitting off stage, watching all this, and I'm going, this stuff really has a cool beat, and I was just I remember driving up. I remember Otis was a real sweet man, and he was real introverted, but he used to have panic attacks sometimes. And I remember driving up, we were driving. It was a long ride from Chicago, and I just remember he had to go to the emergency room, and I was riding in Otis's Cadillac. He had a Cadillac, and he put a little U-Haul trailer in the back with the amps and guitars in it. And I was riding with Sam Lay, and Eddie Shaw was in the band, and a couple others. But I remember we had to go to the emergency room on our way up in the hospital, and Otis went in, and we had to sit out in the car for 2 or 3 hours, and then Otis came out, and he goes, "Doctor said I'm okay. Let's go." So it was that was
Wow.
my I said, "This is like all musicians to me have a character flaw, because they need to be in front of people. Like I think all comedians and all musicians
Sure.
have some kind of shortcoming where they need to try to be great to be accepted." And here I was next to Otis, that I didn't know he was an international star. He was just the guy that led the local band to let me play in his band. And that went on for, I was his first permanent guitar player for 4 or 5 years around then. And I was
Four or
his
five
first
years.
permanent. There was one guy before me that was his rhythm player, a guy named Red, I think. And
Okay.
the rumor is, I heard that Red used to give him $5 a night to learn from him. And then I came in
Wow.
and I was the permanent guitar player. And I remember for the first 2 or 3 months, Otis was would pay me like 5 or 10 bucks appreciation when I was playing and learning, and that was fine with me. And I also remember the very first night that he cut me in and paid me as an equal for the band, and that was monumental to me. And it was the base pay was like $40 a night, and it was fluctuating, because if somebody had been with him a long time, they'd get $50, and like I'd get 5 or 10
Right.
bucks. And so I remember the night he gave me $40, and I said, "Wow." And he said, "Go ahead." And he says, "You know what? Don't count it in front of the other band guys, because no, everybody got a different pay scale." And so I learned that. I said, "Okay, well, that the leader just says, how much each guy makes." He'd call He'd call, there was landlines then. There was no cell phones, to play the
Sure.
gig. They'd have to call your house and say, we're playing a gig tonight. It's I Spy Lounge and it pays, $50. You want to play? And yeah. And so that's the way it went on for years and years. So I learned the mechanics of real blues from real blues guys in Chicago.
Now, Billy, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago that you attended Woodstock, the Woodstock.
Right.
And ironically, I'm wearing this is my piece of stage. This is a piece of the stage from Woodstock.
Okay.
And you
Okay.
can find it at pieceofstage.com. They're not a sponsor. I stumbled on it. It comes with provenance and all kinds of documentation. It's really cool. But I wanted to ask you about that because a friend of mine from down Metro Detroit, Maruga Booker, was playing with a band over there during Woodstock. And so many great bands of that day were there as well as 500,000 people. What was that experience like for you? And were you there for all 3 days?
No, I was, that was what, when I was looking for Paul, when I was living in New York,
Okay.
let's see at that. And I was somehow I was living in New, I was staying in Long Island somewhere. And so I was close to Woodstock. And,
Okay.
I remember, I saw all these posters, Woodstock with all the, Hendrix, da, 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 all the Butterfield, everybody playing. And so I wanted to go there and just see this experience. I had no idea it was going to be an earth-shaking, monumental 500,000 people there. And I had my beetle bug, and I decided to. I think it was Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and so and I think yeah, Hendrix played on Sunday, so I couldn't get it together for the Friday and Saturday. But I thought Sunday I'm going to go and I'm going to go to Woodstock and I'm going to see this experience. So I drove all the way up there, and the closest you could park was about 5 6 miles away. It was just chaos, it was just
Yeah.
everybody was, the cars were, it was gridlock. And so I got it like 4 or 5 miles from the Woodstock actual scene. And so I just parked on the road, because everything was gridlocked and there was no, people were driving off and parking in the ditches and in the
Wow.
farms, and it was all hippies, and I was a hippie. I had bell bottoms and I had hair down here, and
Sure.
so I parked my Volkswagen, and I was with my girlfriend at the time, and so we had sandwiches and stuff. We thought we'd stay for the day, and it was raining. And so I thought, well, so we walked about 2 miles, 3 miles. And as we walked, people were coming back just covered with mud. And they goes, you don't want to go down there. It's a mud pit and everything. And I said, I don't care. It's music. I want to see it. And we got closer and closer and closer, and people were just coming back covered with mud. And so we got up to the gate, and it had already thinned out because it was raining, and you saw all the films of all the mudslides and everything that was going on. And so the gates had already been crashed, and we were wet and soaked, and I was just and so we gave up and turned around at that point. But I was on the property, I was at Woodstock, and I was right at the gate. And I wish I'd have stayed, because Hendrix didn't play till the next morning. I mean,
Right.
I was about to sit around in the mud for all night and be wet. But I mean, if I would have known the history, I certainly would have. But that
Sure.
was my experience with Woodstock. But I was there,
Yeah, that's cool, man. So after working with Otis Rush and playing about for a bit, you started another band, and this one had personal ties to your own name. I'd love to hear the story behind, was that Horace Monster? Is that what you called
Yeah, Horace Monster. That was my rock and
it?
roll. I played with Otis for so long, and I stood behind him, and he was a great man, and I finally realized how famous he really was. And it was real flattering, but I still had the fire that, I had real long hair, and I wanted to play rock. I wanted to use Marshall amps. We had two Fender basement amps, with the old Fender basements with four 10-inch speakers, 40 watts, and we turn it all the way up and it would sustain. You use that sound, and I wanted to play rock and roll, so I decided to leave Otis, and who, by the way, Bob Levitz took my place. And he was such a gentleman. He called me and he goes, he heard word. Everybody wanted to play with Otis Rush, and he got the word through the grapevine. He said, Billy Pruitt left Otis Rush, man. The gig's open. And so Bob Levitz called me, and I'd never had anybody ask me to have their blessing. He said, man, I really want the gig, but if you're going to stay, I don't want to step on your toes. And I said, no, I want to play rock and roll, and I'm going to start a band. He goes, great. Can I approach Otis and get the gig? And I said, sure, man. Thanks for calling, you know? And so he approached Otis and asked him, you know, to be, and he ended up playing with Otis for the rest of his life and the rest of Otis's life, you know. Yeah. Anyway, but that was nice, Bob Lovitz. Anyway, so I got into Horace Monster was the rock and roll band that was a four piece band in the beginning and then a five piece. And it was just heavy metal rock and roll. And it's we played bars and you know, tore it up for 6 or 7 years without a personnel change. And
Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah.
It was a good little run. Good little run. We were voted the number one of the years we were voted the number one club act by the Chicago Reader in the bar scene. But we never really got past bars. And then I started fading back into the blues again. And that's I've gone full circle, you know. And now I'm 100% back in the blues, you know. And
Sure.
you know, I'll be, you know, I want to go out every night and play, but I'll be 81 in August, so it's hard for me to stay up till 3 in the morning. I just can't do it, you know. So I like the little gigs, you know, where, you know, it's a jam session. You come in at 7 and I can get home and get in bed by 10 o'clock.
There you go. I think you might be just a few days younger than my mother. She was born in August 1st of 45.
Well,
So it's always easy for me to remember name because or her age because she was always 20 years older than me. But you truly did come up in an amazing time, man. You
yeah, I know.
played with and for some of the greatest names in the blues. Billy, what was the single most important life lesson that you gleaned from those experiences with all those musicians?
Boy, that's I don't know. Just do your best and always I've learned to surround yourself with people that are better than you because you always learn. You know, you always learn. Some people, you know, I've always been the leader of my bands, and a lot of leaders, they like to surround themselves with people that don't quite have their experience and their knowledge, and that elevates them. But
Sure.
I found that that doesn't that you know, you're only as good as the people you surround yourself with. And so if you can put yourself with people that are more experienced than you and know music better than you, they'll bring you up, you know, just like Otis. He just showed me we never rehearsed. And, you know, he'd just say the next gig is so and so, and he showed me how to play a shuffle. I had no idea, you know, and a shuffle is you know, like a foxtrot, you know, like a horse galloping. And he'd go, no, just play the drums on your guitar. Ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And he taught me all those little things that are, you know, so hard to learn, and I learned from the masters. So I don't know. I would say just, you know, to try to get better, surround yourself with people that are better than you. Although I love jam sessions, and I love, you know, people come up that have no experience, and you always encourage them, you know, and you get around people that blow your mind, and you know, and I'm so humbled to be around anybody that can play. Mike Wheeler and I are really tight. Mike Wheeler's a
Oh, I
great,
love
great
Mike.
player. And he's so prolific. He's got, I don't know, 10 or 15 albums already, and he's a great writer. And I met him at the Otis Rush tribute. It was about 10 years ago at the
Okay.
it was the last show at the Petrillo Band Shell, and that's when I first met him. And he came. We were rehearsing for they had horns and everything. Dick Sherman produced it, and that's the first time I met Mike. And you know, he came in, and he was pinch hitting for some of the bands that couldn't fly in that day, and so he was doing the vocals, and he was tuning his guitar, and he goes, man, you got a tuner. And I loaned him my tuner, and he tuned up his guitar, and then he sang a song that wasn't even in his key, and I says, man, you sound great. And he goes, oh, thank you, sir. And then Rich Sherman told him that I was Otis Rush's guitar player, and then ever since then he's had a lot of respect for me, and he bring me up to play, and we're real tight. I just last Sunday I he played a he played a duo with his bass player at Buddy Guy's
Yeah,
Legends,
yeah.
and I just showed up with my harps, And he always brings me up, ladies and gentlemen, he's so polite, got a blues legend, Billy Bruce. And he brought me up and he says, we're supposed to, he was supposed to play 40 minute sets between 5 and 7. And I showed up about, 5:30, and we were playing. And he said, the audience was being real receptive because Mike's such a great singer. He was playing acoustic guitar and I just play an acoustic harp. And he says, I never get to play with Billy. We're just going to go through. And he played a 2-hour set, and I had no idea what he was going to do. And
Wow.
so it was hard. But, there was a lot of people at Legends early. That was Friday. No, Sunday night. Anyway, there was a
Okay.
lot of people there. They came to see Mike, So, it was really nice. He was, I gave him one of my guitars that I used in Horace Monster from 1970 or something. And,
Very
you know,
cool.
And
He's
anyway,
actually
we'll.
he's going to be here on the 18th. They're doing a fundraiser for the Killer Blues Headstone Project up in Muskegon, and Demetria Taylor's coming up to play, and he's going to be him and his band are going to be backing her. So, looking forward to seeing Mike. And oh, I love Larry. The man shot out of a cannon all the
Yeah,
time. But
that's what they've been really tight for,
oh
the
yeah.
story that Mike told me was that when Mike and him went to high school together, and Mike hadn't put a band together yet. That's a story that I got. And Larry had already been playing. He had his own band, and so Mike wanted to join his band or something like that. And somehow they got together and started playing, and they've been together ever since. And that was, Mike's. Not as old as me, but they've been real tight ever since, and they can feel
Yes,
each
sir.
other, and they play when they do acoustic sets. They have such tight band arrangements that it's so impressive. They did all the copy stuff they do is so tight, and Mike does all original stuff. That was, he was, I was playing harp with him through a lot of his original stuff that I had no idea. I didn't do my homework, but I sloshed around the corners and I did just fine. Mike's so humble and he's so generous,
So, going back to my earlier question about the people that you've played with, did you get any, are there any really good pieces of advice that you collected along the way from some of these big guys?
That they told me, Howlin' Wolf was a good lesson. I At Mother Blues, I used to watch him play every night, and one of my podcast things are about that. By the way, my podcast is Talk a Blues Streak, and it's available on every platform. And it's long, little 20-minute programs about just well produced. A guy named Hector Perez said, "Why don't we do a podcast?" 2 years ago, and I didn't even know what a podcast was, and I thought it was some kind of live radio broadcast or something. And a lot of it is, but he goes, "No, let's just do stories about you." Anyway, he's the producer, and Linda Milazzo is the executive producer, and they helped me with all that stuff. But anyway, you're saying advice. I went to sit in with Howlin' Wolf. I kept asking him if I could sit in, and I was just, this white boy who was a fan who wanted to sit in. And so he goes, "Well, you come up last set. Maybe you could do a little something." And so I came up last set, and so he played some real good song, 44 or something, really good song. And I was at that time. That was before I got the job with Otis. To me, a great guitar player was Mike Bloomfield for Butterfield, because he
Oh,
was a
yeah.
classic, and Mike Bloomfield was just a barrage of notes like an AK-47. And I always thought the faster you could play, the better you were. That's how you're gauged as a guitar player. Just like when I was 15 in bands, I thought the higher you could sing, the better singer you were, So I used to play Johnny B. Goode. So I thought that if I could sing real high, then I was a good singer. So anyway, my experience was before I got with Otis, my perception of a great player was Mike Bloomfield, a great blues player, because he played so fast. So when Wolf let me come up and play with him, I thought I'm gonna impress him now, and so we started this. I think it was 44. Really good traditional blues. Da, 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 da. And he goes, "I'll nod to you when it's time." Da, da, da. And so he nodded to me, and I went, "Yeah." And he just took my arm, and he pushed me off the stage, and he goes, "Let's give him a hand as he leaves the bandstand." So I had the honor of getting thrown by a Howlin' Wolf. But the lesson to be learned was to learn spacing and learn pacing and to learn and play the appropriate part at the appropriate time. And the most important notes are the notes that you don't play. Leave a space, leave a hole, leave that's all in my podcast, the lessons I learned. So it's play the appropriate part, and don't try to play too much. And don't try to be too fancy. Just play the right part, and that's then people will respect you for playing the right part, not trying to be, Jimi Hendrix plays the blues, which I'm guilty of also. I love my whammy bar and all that stuff, but I try to hold back. So that's one of the lessons.
Billy, where do you feel you fit in the history of the Chicago blues and the genre in general?
Boy, I'm not sure. I'm in the artist protection program, so people, they hear Billy Crudup and they go, "Who?" And well, I'm just some guy that plays. I'm not sure. I'm just I never I never traveled. I never went to Europe with all these guys, and promoted myself. I'm just happy to play and just play wherever I can and do whatever I do. I'm not sure how I'm perceived, and it's fine with me. Sometimes, people have no idea who I am, and I go to jam sessions and they go, "Whoever you are, go sign the list. You're down at your number 23. We'll bring you up when it's time." And then other times I go, other times I walk in and people go, "Come on up." They let me cut in front of the line, because they respect me and they've heard of me. So, I don't know. I really don't know where I fit in. I honestly don't. But I'm happy to be a small part of the blues scene, and some people know who I am, and I still have to earn it. I feel I just every day I just play a little guitar and a little harp every day just to keep my chops up, because if I lose my hands now at 80, I'll never get it back. So I'm happy just to be around and just try to play a little music here and there.
Looking back over your 7+ decades in music, do you still have some unfinished business, do you think? Are there things you still want to do? Any musician or musicians you'd still like to play with?
Oh yeah, I mean every all I've outlived a lot of them, that I wanted to play with, but
Yes, sir.
everybody I'd love to play with Clapton or anybody. I mean, Hendrix is long gone, and to me he was the god of everything. He nobody ever played like him, and nobody ever when I, Buddy Miles and I used to hang around, and there's an episode on the podcast about that he was going to take me to introduce Hendrix, and that could have gone somewhere probably. I don't know, but I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I want to do. The podcast is keeping me going now. It's just little well-produced stories that are about some of the stuff I've done and some of the artists I've been with. We're working on one, Freddie King. It'll be out in a couple of weeks now. That
Nice.
Freddie King, when I was playing with Otis Rush, a place called the I Spy Lounge, one night Freddie King just walked in the door, and Otis said, "Come on up," and he just went up on the stage, and I played like a couple hours with him, and he showed me some stuff, and he left, and that was my ex I got to play on stage with Freddie King. I mean,
That's cool.
my God, what is, I mean, what is cooler than that, and Otis Rush and these guys, and in their lifetime, I'd like to, there's a lot of stuff I still want to do. I just want to keep playing as long as I can. Just like
Sure.
Mike says, Mike goes, "Why don't you come out and play me?" He calls me all the time. He goes, "I'm checking on you, man. I haven't seen you in a couple of months." I said, "I'm feeling my age, Mike." And he goes, "Well, I'm feeling my age too, but that doesn't stop me. I'm going to keep going as long as I can." So, I don't know. That's all I can do,
You should sneak up to Muskegon for the 18th. You really should.
For
That would
that, for
be
the thing that Mike's doing.
Yeah, well, it's a fundraiser, and he's playing, his band is backing Demetria, I'll send you
Okay.
the information. If you can
Okay.
do it, that
You
would
never
be
know.
so cool, man.
You never know.
And I would cover your ticket if you came out. That would be awesome.
Well, thank you. Thank you. That's
So
great, man.
that'd be
So
fun.
I don't have to sign the sit-in sheet and come up 20th
No,
or whatever.
but I'll make sure if you show up, I'll make sure to put a bug in Mike's ear. 'Cause
Oh
I
yeah,
think
no, Mike.
that'd just be cooler than hell.
Yeah, that would be fun. And Mike, he
Yeah.
loves to play. Like I said, yeah, Sunday at Buddy Guy's, he said, "We're just that was a story I didn't finish you." Yeah, we were play. He did a 2-hour set, and he goes, "We're supposed to take a break, but I never get to play with Billy, so we're just gonna go all the way through till 7:30 or whatever it was, seven."
Wow.
And so I did a 2-hour set with him, and the audience was real, real nice, And I can't, like I say, people just don't know. He goes, "There's Billy Pruitt, Billy Pruitt." And so when I came off stage, or there were a couple of people sitting up front, and I do shameless self-promotion. I carry my little business cards around with my gold guitar, my Billy Pruitt, and the people in front, I said, "Oh, here's my business card." And they said, "No, we Googled you while you were playing, man. We know who you are." And I said, "Great, so and, that's great." So some people, you get recognized, but that's not why you do it. You do the music because you love it. It gives me chills when the groove is right. My favorite changes are no changes. Blues are 1-4-5. It's 3 chords. It's all the But my favorite changes are Smokestack Lightning. Songs that just have a groove. And to me, it's the beauty of repetition. That's what Prince said. The beauty of repetition, it's hypnotic. Just the same thing over and over. I can listen to it for 20 minutes, one song. If the groove is right, then you play the harmonica. And if you can give people the chills, then you did it. And some nights are better than others, but you can't be afraid. You can't be afraid. You just go up and do it, I mean, sometimes you strike lightning, and sometimes, you should have stayed home. But hey. You get what you get. It's only as good, you're only as good as your last performance.
Yeah, right on. Now, after you turned 80 last year, you said in an interview that your next goal was to make 100. What will you do when you reach that milestone? What do you got planned?
Oh man, I just want to be able to keep playing. And I mean, it's a good gimmick, when they help you up on stage, you get the sympathy applause, "Oh, look, he doesn't even know where he is, and I, hey, you kids, am I at the ballpark? What the hell is going? Oh, the audience is here." It's like, so, but yeah, it's entertaining. I remember I was at the end, I saw Sam Lay, and they helped him up on stage. I just went as a, and it's just so, when somebody's great, and they've been great, even if they're not great at the time. What's his name? Simmons. Is it Bob Simmons? No. Anyway, he just passed away last week. He was a
Okay.
bass player that played, and a guitar player that played with Carlos Showers all the time, Carlos Flowers, and we played together all the time. But you just remember how great they were when, if they ever did it, if it was ever good in the past, it's still good. It's like some people say, "Oh, I don't like, Sly or something, one of these bands, because that's old, And if it was ever good, it's still good, just like the blues, if it's ever good, it's still good. So if you can go up and represent something that you used to do, even though you probably don't have all your chops about you, at least, you're still trying, you're still paying homage, you're still playing, you're still trying to keep the blues alive, you're still respecting it. And I love the blues, because there's no, you can play on autopilot, and that's what I like about it. You don't have to think about the changes. You don't have to think about, it's like sometimes the jazz guys look down on blues players, because they go, "Well, you can't read music. You don't even know what you're playing." And I go, "I know, but I think it sounds cool, doesn't it? Listen, And they go, "Yeah, but you don't. Is that a 64th note?" I say, "I don't know. I have no idea. But I look at the whammy bar, man. This is, look how cool it sounds. Maybe you'll get the chills a little bit." So, if you can still represent some of what you used to do when you were young, I think it's valid. But,
Indeed.
I don't know. That's if it was ever good, it's still good. If it was good in the past, it's still good. The beauty of repetition. I just like blues, because over and over and over, I can just go up and just play on autopilot. When the changes are coming, or if there's no changes, it's even better,
Indeed. Talk a Blues Streak, the complete documentary, is, in my opinion, required viewing if you're a fan of the blues. This program contains an interview with you, hosted by blues historian Dick Sherman, and features Chicago Blues Hall of Famer Mike Wheeler, the aforementioned Mike Wheeler, and the last known interview and final performance with the legendary Sam Lay. This is the only blues documentary to ever win an Emmy Award. How cool is that?
I know. Can you believe it? I mean, can you believe it? I just thought, you know,
so
I just
much for the artist protection program.
Right. So I thought, well, I'd like to document some of the stuff I've done, you know, some of the roads I've been down. I think it's kind of valid. So we did it at Rock. It's called Rocket Productions, Chicago. And that's where I met Hector Perez, the producer, and he really got into it. I said, I want to do some kind of documentary, just to kind of document stuff. And I had I thought it was just going to be, you know, a little black and white thing with lousy sound and out of focus, and you know, at least it's something. You know, when I'm gone, they'll say, oh yeah, that guy, I remember him a little bit, We decided to do it at a club called Blues on Halsted. It's right across the street from Kingston Mines.
Yes, sir.
And they've been long gone and closed. And I think they're going to tear the building down. But we were, Rich and I said, I want to do a documentary. You want to do it? And he said, sure. Because I've known him 50 years. You know, he used to come to see us with Otis Rush. And so he was happy to do that with me. And, so we just the two of us played, and he did the interview, and we chopped it together and made a documentary, and it won a regional Emmy, and no blues documentary has ever won an Emmy, so that kind of validates something. I mean, it's got
And as a blues historian, which is what I'm aspiring to be with this program,
you are already.
As I said, it's required. It's required study. I mean, this was a great program that you guys put together. And then, of course, you have the Talk a Blues Streak podcast, which you have shamelessly promoted several times already. I was going to get to it, but I wanted to wait and get to it towards the end. But these are really cool because, unlike a program like Time Signatures, which runs on average 30 to 45 minutes, in this case, we're coming up on an hour.
I'm sorry.
No. When you got somebody that likes to talk, I've learned, especially somebody that has stories like you've got, I'm not going to shut you down. I told you that when we talked about scheduling this in the first place. But I love the approach that you take with this, because they're little bite-sized chunks of your own blues history done your way. Yeah. And I really have to tell you, man, I'm a fan. I am.
Thank you, man.
And it looks like this is something you're going to continue to add. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the best thing I've ever done. You know, I did my own album with Donny Hathaway, Sam Lay, Phil Upchurch. And, you know, that's
an album I still haven't found yet, by the way.
It's out of print. We printed 100 copies and that was it. You know, I know it's out of, but that's not my best work. But Talk a Blues Streak is just really valid. You know, it's just, it's just such well-produced stories. And, you know, I'm really proud of it, you know, and I'm just trying to leave something behind so that one day, you know, somebody will say, oh yeah, that guy, you know, yeah, that guy, he did something. Like I say, Mike Wheeler helped me win the Emmy, because he narrated a lot of the documentary. It's an hour and a half, so if you're going to watch it, you better make popcorn, you know. Create your own.
I just hit the pause button if I need to do something and come back.
It goes on forever, you know. But
I would like to recommend to you, especially since you're doing these as a preservation step, to consider the Blues Archive at the University of Mississippi. That's where this program gets housed. When we get done each season, I send them down to Greg Johnson and the people down there at UMass. And they preserve this kind of stuff. And I'm telling you, to have those little bite-sized chunks stored and preserved for generations to come, to me, would be a no-brainer.
That's great. Yeah, I love, yeah. Streak is, we put a lot of history, a lot of blues history. That's my contribution, you know. That's, it's a lot of stuff pays high to all, everything about how these blues people got to where they were and what they went through. And, you know, that's what a documentary should be, I think. So I'm
Yes,
paying
sir.
tribute to all the blues people that, you know, I mean, that's really valid, and I think it's really important, and you can't do it enough, you know. And there's so much history here in Chicago. Like I say, you
Indeed.
know, the Chess recording studios. I like to play the concerts in the afternoon, you know, and during the summer. And I guess Muddy's house, they're opening today. That's the grand opening. Was that?
That's what I'm hearing.
Yes.
So
Yeah.
that's, yeah, I'm definitely going to want to get over there and check that out. Well,
Yeah. It'll probably
Billy,
stop.
where can we send people to learn more about you since you're in the Artist Protection Program
Yeah, right.
and
It's
one of
hard.
the blues' best kept secrets? Where can we send people?
That's right. Well, they see, you know, if they see my name in print, they redact it. But just my website. I try to stay in touch with the website, billypruitt.com. And that's spelled, that's the Mississippi spelling, like Jeannie Pruitt, Prewitt. You know, most people go Pruit, which is correct too. Billypruitt.com. That's got links to everything. And I put on the events page, I put all, you know, I'm doing this thing in Vermont this summer, and you know, whenever, you know, I'm flattered when people want me to play. All you got to do is ask nice, and I'll come play, you know. So, you
Sure.
know, I'm happy to play. So anyway, that's the whole history of everything is at billypruitt.com. But listen to Talk of Blue Streak. That's, you know, it's really well produced. I really owe it to Hector and Linda Milazzo. I mean, they, you know, it's really valid, you know, because we put a lot of history about
Right.
how those artists got somewhere and everything. And then it's my interaction with them. There's always a tie to Freddie King and Howlin' Wolf and James Brown and all these people, Buddy Miles. You know, it's valid history. And to me, blues is really interesting, you know, just to, you know, it's to believe, you know, it's like I'm looking at somebody else when I see the what I used to do walking around Old Town in the 60s. And here, you know, all these guys were playing every night in bars. You could just walk in and
Man.
talk to them and listen to them. And I was there, you know. And if only I would have known, you know, what kind of history. I had some idea, but I didn't think it was really, you know, going to happen. I thought the coolest thing ever was the first Paul Butterfield album. And, you know, maybe I'd get to go to Big John's and go into the bar and listen to him. So
Well, Billy Pruitt, I want to thank you once again, man. I appreciate
thank you,
your
man.
time, and I thank you so much for allowing me to preserve another slice of blues history with you today. Much appreciation, and I look forward to seeing you perform one of these days. I'll bring my camera. I'm a photographer. I'll bring my camera with me and get some good shots for you. How's that?
That'd be great. Now let's do it again. Can we do it again in another 20 years? I don't know. I don't know if
Absolutely.
I'll make it. I don't know if I'll make it. We'll see. Another 10
All
years,
right,
maybe. We'll
sir.
see. All
All
right.
right, sir.
Thanks,
We'll
Jim.
be. And that wraps up this edition of Time Signatures. Once again, my thanks to our guest, Billy Pruitt, but also to you, for without you, none of this would be possible. Jim Irvin reminding you, keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues, one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long, everybody.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.